You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in London, which are the only translators of Steiner into English and give me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a set of cycles of lectures, Collected Works, Volume 181 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Dying Earth and Living Cosmos, The Living Gifts of Anthroposophy, The Need for New Forms of Consciousness. This is the first cycle, Dying Earth and Living Cosmos, Lecture 5, given in Berlin on the 12th of March, 1918. In connection, especially with human souls, who have crossed the threshold of death, we have been trying to study how the world we live in between birth and death is related to the one we dwell in between death and a new birth. Our aim here will be to try to explore these relationships from the most diverse angles. As humanity increasingly comes to approach the world of spirit with inquiring insight, as it must do if it is to meet its pressing tasks in forthcoming times, it will discover that a proper, exhaustive understanding of the world and humankind goes far, far beyond what can be discovered through the physical, sense-based sciences and the powers of reason on which they rely. If we draw only on what we perceive through our senses and on the powers of reason bound up with these senses, we can discover only a very limited part of the real world, by which I mean the world of active reality, in which we ourselves are also integrated as active participants. In the course of these lectures, I have suggested how we can refine our powers of observation, expanding their scope to include various aspects of life that are not usually considered, because we tend only to focus on what actually happens during our waking life from morning to evening, and not what could or might otherwise have happened, what, in a sense, we were prevented from doing. In order to offer you at least some tentative ideas about such things, which have to be felt initially more than thought, I asked you to envisage, say, being prevented from leaving the house at a previously intended time because someone comes to the door. You might have planned to go out at 11 in the morning, but can only do so half an hour later. Now try to picture what difference it may, only may though, have made to your whole day to leave half an hour later. During this half an hour, it is possible that something could have happened to you that did not then happen. Try to consider all the possible similar events and incidents that can impinge on us in daily life, and you can form an idea of all that might have occurred but did not, then, especially attending to a feeling sense of it, try to compare this idea of what might have happened with what did actually happen during your day, how one thing led to another by cause and effect. To form a really clear picture of such things, it is a good idea to compare them with similar phenomena in the natural world. In nature, there are processes at work that must be seen in a similar light. I have often pointed out how many seeds are lost and do not grow. Ask yourself how many herring eggs actually grow into herrings in the course of a year, and how many are lost. Then, broaden this idea across the whole of life. Try to picture how many seeds with the potential for life do not actually develop, are left out of the rest of nature sprouting, flourishing life, and never unfold. Do not for a moment think this is not intrinsic to reality. It is as much a part of it as all that does develop fully. But instead of unfolding, it comes only to a certain point and then takes a different course, in the same way that in our own daily lives we are prevented from doing something. These events that did not happen in life are comparable to natural processes that never developed, but which instead evolve in a different direction. There is something else, surely very similar to these two examples, that poses a riddle for us, and greatly affects human life. A normal human lifespan is between 70 and 90 years, but a very large number of people die earlier than this, as we know. Life does not, therefore, come to its full fruition. In the same way that in nature seeds are held back at an early stage and do not unfold and ripen, so human life often does not reach its full maturity. Our daily actions, as we have seen, often do not unfold and mature completely either, for reasons we have seen. All this can show us that between the lines of life, as it were, a great deal exists that we fail to consider, and that instead of entering realms where it becomes tangible, sensory reality, it remains in spiritual realms. If we dwell on this thought in really fruitful ways, rather than seeing it only as a fantasy, it can lead us toward a picture, if not yet full proof, of something very important. In ordinary life we reflect upon our actions, our deeds, and will impulses. We think what we ought to do and carry out what we have thought of. But life is not only like that, planning actions and carrying them out. There is another element to life whereby things happen and often appear to us as a collection of random events, seemingly without rhyme or reason, chance connections and incidents, which we can sum up as, in quotes, destiny, or in quotes, fate. For people who think in materialistic ways, fate is composed of occurrences that just happen to them on a daily basis. Of course, many people have an inkling, nevertheless, of some kind of hidden plan at work in this fate. But they do not usually make any headway in really understanding what is at work here. Although these things are of great importance, little attention is generally paid to them. Currently, analytic psychology, as it is known, psychoanalysis, is delving into various things that are knocking on humanity's door. The proponents of this analytic psychology, however, approach these realities with inadequate means. In our circles, I have often described a paradoxical instance, much used by psychoanalysts, because as psychoanalysis was just starting, it led to an insight into all the elements of the psyche at work in life, concealed from most people's view. Although some of you have heard this before, I would like to describe this paradoxical example to you again here. A woman is invited to a dinner party one evening, which is being held as a farewell to the lady of the house, who is ill and is about to depart for a cure at a spa resort. The evening goes very smoothly. The lady leaves for her spa cure, and more or less at the same time she leaves, the other guests also depart. A group of these guests walks down the street together, when all of a sudden a horse-drawn cab comes around the corner. Please note, not a car, but a horse-drawn cab. The cab hurtles down the street. One of the ladies and the company separates from the rest of the group, and while the others step aside to avoid the cab, she alone has the odd idea of running along in front of the horses. She runs down the street in front of them and feels she has to do something to save herself from the horses behind her. Arriving at a bridge over a river, she conceives the idea of saving herself by jumping into the water. But the other guests have, of course, run after her in the meantime and manage to head her off in time. Then she is taken back to the house they had all left and is received there. All well and good. The lady of the house is left. The woman is given accommodation there and is now able to continue a relationship with the man of the house which had begun some time previously. Exploring hidden regions of the psyche, the psychoanalyst discovers that as a child this woman had certain experiences with horses, and that these have resurfaced from the unconscious, and so forth. But if we know something about the human soul, we will not concur with all these theories. Granted, hidden regions of the soul do exist, but they are only the precursors of what really counts here and not the full reality. The thing of importance here is that the woman in question has an unconscious awareness, which in certain circumstances is far slyer and more refined than her surface consciousness. In her conscious mind, as you will agree, the woman in question has behaved in a fairly clumsy way, but in her subconscious was something far slyer and more scheming. This something in her subconscious thought as follows: the lady of the house has left. I must find some way or other of meeting her husband. I must use the next opportunity that presents itself. The subconscious can be rather prophetic and has an intimation of what will happen if one runs in front of horses. It can organize things in the slyest way. The conscious mind is not so crafty. The subconscious has this craftiness enhanced by a certain prophetic gift. I mention this example here because it illustrates something generally true. We all bear within us something that is far more comprehensive and also far more intense in various ways than our ordinary consciousness. If we were consciously aware of all that we know in our subconscious, we would be terribly clever and crafty and would be able to conceive of and think out all kinds of things. We can now ask whether what lives in our subconscious is entirely inactive. If we know how to observe the world spiritually, we find this is not so. On the contrary, it is continually active, is at work all the time. What occurred in the case of this lady, and in similar instances, only comes to the fore abnormally, under the influence of quite particular events, desires, and inclinations, is always present in us in a certain realm, accompanying us throughout our waking life. The way the subconscious manifested in this woman on one occasion, and it could of course have been a man, is due only to the fact that our subconscious knowledge of life occasionally bursts its bounds. This can also be true of ordinary awareness, that sometimes we do something particular that does not form part of our customary way of doing things, that seems exceptional. The same is true of the subconscious. But here, in this case, something unusual emerged that is always active in people. How is it active? What we call fate or destiny is really a very complex thing. Our destiny seems to approach us in the form of events that happen to us. Let us take a striking instance of destiny, something many people will be familiar with. Let us assume a person meets another who then becomes his friend, or wife, or husband. To the surface mind, it seems that this happened to us, and that we ourselves did nothing to bring it about. The other simply entered our life, but this is not the case. The truth is quite different. From the moment of our birth, and still more from the moment we start to say capital I of ourselves, we arrange our path in life with the power residing in the subconscious in such a way that it crosses another's path at a certain moment. People are unaware of the remarkable things they would find if they could trace someone's path in life, say that of someone who gets engaged. If we traced this person's life path through childhood and youth, from place to place, until he gets engaged, we would find a great deal of purpose and meaning in its sequence. We would discover that he did not simply arrive at a place where this happened to him randomly, but that he moved purposefully toward circumstances where he met the other. The whole of life is filled with such a searching, and the whole of destiny is a search of this kind. However, we have to realize that this search does not take place in the same way as actions we decide on and then carry out in a linear fashion. Subconscious actions occur with strong personal impetus. There is a purpose at work in our subconscious. It isn't actually correct to speak of the unconscious, but we should refer to the surface or upper consciousness and the subconscious, since it is unconscious only for our ordinary awareness. In the case of the lady who arranged things so craftily, in order to return to the house of the man she was drawn to, the subconscious was far more conscious of what it was doing than the lady herself in her surface consciousness. The same is true of what guides us through life, so that our destiny is a weft that leads us and is in fact very, very conscious. The fact that people often resist their destiny does not contradict this. If they should survey all the factors involved, they would stop resisting it. The surface or upper consciousness is not as sly and crafty as the subconscious, and therefore often judges the latter's reality wrongly. It thinks something unpleasant has occurred to it, whereas, in fact, the person has actually himself sought what he superficially thinks unpleasant, doing so out of profound deliberation. Insight into deeper contexts would lead him to see that a greater intelligence seeks the things that become our destiny or fate. On what is all this based? In speaking of these things, for which ordinary language has no proper words, we have to resort to metaphors. Our ordinary mind, focused in the head and highly valued by many, is like a sieve. This simile has some truth. Our head-based consciousness is a sieve. If you pour water into a sieve, it runs through and does not fill it. The things which our subconscious deliberates upon, and which then come to expression in the fabric of our destiny, pass through our head consciousness as though through a sieve. And this is why our surface awareness knows nothing of them. Our head consciousness lets them pass through as if through a sieve, while our subconscious retains them. We know nothing about them, only because they pass through the sieve of our surface awareness in this way. Nevertheless, we retain them. When science develops to the point where it studies these things properly, people will inquire into these processes in animals as compared to the human being. In the case of an animal, the whole creature is a sieve, and these things pass right through it. In the human being, on the other hand, they pass through the head, but are retained in the whole of the rest of the organism. Under ordinary circumstances, though, since the whole person does not think, but only his head, we do not think these things. We are unaware of their existence in us. Only where hysterical conditions arise, a pathological, abnormal state, that involves the rest of the human organism beginning to think too, do we discover exceptional instances where awareness arises of processes of destiny, in which, if you like, we weave our destiny, as happened in the case I have described of the lady who took destiny into her hands. So we do retain these things within us. And here we find something very remarkable. Why do they pass right through the animal, whereas they are retained in us human beings? It is because the animal has no hands. In other words, the creature's limbs are always connected with the earth, whether these limbs are legs or wings, though the picture alters somewhat in the latter case. The fact that we have transformed animal limbs into our arms and hands means they are integrated in our organism in a way that enables us to retain our thoughts within us in our destiny. But we cannot think with our hands. We can only retain or hold back our destiny with them, and therefore we are unaware of it. The hands are organs of thinking in the same way that the etheric aspect of the head is. In thinking, the etheric part of the head does something very similar to what we do with our hands. Using our hands, we bring to cessation the flow of action pervading our destiny. Our nature is such that only the coarser reasoning activities of hands and arms come to expression. Everyone knows that we possess a special, in quotes, fingertip sensitivity. But this represents only the very coarsest aspect of what I am describing, which is something extremely subtle, a very weak, scarcely glimmering thinking, which we develop there, and which we can express in artistic activity. Our hands are actually integrated into our overall organism as organs of thinking for our destiny. At our current stage of evolution, people have not yet learned to think with their hands. If they did, if they learned the secrets of the hands, this would, at the same time, lead them to insight into the fundamental laws of destiny. This sounds very strange, but is true. Spiritual science can show us that destiny is thought in our hands, that the latter develop a subconscious thinking. Science is as yet unaware of this. Inevitably, scientists regard the human being as just a more perfect animal, which is also true. But the major distinction between the human being and the animal lies in factors scientists are unaware of or do not consider. Think for a moment what the animal's head is. It rests directly above the earth. The earth carries it. Whereas the human head rests upon us in a way we ourselves sustain or carry. The pull of gravity passes first through the human organism, through the diaphragm, before it meets the earth. We relate to ourselves as the animal does to the earth. The pull of gravity on the animal's head passes directly into the earth, without first passing through its organism and diaphragm. Our human orientation to the whole cosmos is the essential factor, and connected with this orientation is the fact that our arms and hands are differently organized from the corresponding limbs of animals. This is one thing science will study in future, asking how we relate dynamically to the cosmos, what forces are at work here to make us two-legged instead of four. We are organized like this through the influences of the cosmos. And we meet this organizing power of the cosmos by virtue of the fact that the line of gravity from our head passes into and through us ourselves, so that we become our own earth. By configuring and organizing our hands and arms in a distinctive way, our hands can meet and engage with destiny, can grasp it, just as the organization of the human head also relates to our upright posture. Our more perfect brain is something we possess because the line of gravity of our head does not pass directly through the earth, but instead first through ourselves. There are powers at work everywhere in the cosmos, and when something is differently oriented, mass is differently distributed. This is acknowledged in respect of inorganic substance. But as yet, people fail to discern the same thing at work in the human being. And in consequence, people fail to see how our material body works toward and meets the spirit, just as spirit everywhere permeates matter. That is one aspect. Here we can say that we discern the human being resting upon his own diaphragm, and whereas our understanding otherwise only extends to conscious actions, in thinking down to the diaphragm with the subconscious, we can gain understanding of destiny. Thus we have seen, firstly, that if we go beyond a one-sided view of the head and consider the whole of the rest of our organism, we can deliberate upon and evaluate our destiny, albeit subconsciously. We can determine and know our destiny. But secondly, something else is true, too. We engage in actions. In life, these cause us either a certain satisfaction or dissatisfaction. If you consider a kind action you have performed for someone, this will give you a sense of satisfaction. Whereas, something you did to defend yourself in some way is connected with a sense of dissatisfaction, and so on. We are continually doing diverse things. But besides the things we do that cause us conscious satisfaction or dissatisfaction, there are other kinds of action. We can examine this best if through spiritual science we study actions that have little impact on life. Chopping wood is an action which may have little intrinsic moral significance. It makes us feel tired. People think all kinds of things about tiredness. As we saw in the last public lecture I gave, people think that tiredness is the cause of sleep, that the first leads to the second. We all know that tiredness can arise as an accompaniment to actions such as chopping wood. But in fact, this tiredness turns out to be very significant if we study it through spiritual science. It is not at all what we usually consider it to be, but something quite different. Parenthesis, actions of a more intellectual or moral character are similar in this respect, but more refined. And there it is harder to discern what I am speaking of than in more elementary actions, such as wood chopping. Close parenthesis. You can easily see that the tiredness arising during such actions is a dual process. First, we need to apply our flourishing life forces to the task in hand, powers connected with our growth, and then we expend or exhaust these powers, giving rise to a degradation process we experience as tiredness. In fact, this tiredness is a numbing or stupefaction whose deeper importance we in fact experience as something quite different from a consequence of, in this case, chopping wood. For ordinary life, tiredness is only a numbing of something. What is it we are really experiencing here? Of course, only real spiritual scientific research can cast light on this. When we are tired after chopping wood, we discover that one of the so-called lotus flowers, part of the human being's spiritual organism, you can learn more about this in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, starts to shine out strongly. A success has occurred of which we are unaware. This spiritual success remains unconscious, and what we consciously experience is the numbing that occurs in order for us not to perceive this success. A real spiritual emanation occurs here. And we can understand this still better if, to grasp the spiritual nature of such emanation, we consider, say, an action involving a moral judgment. Let us imagine that we have not merely chopped wood, but instead accomplished an action arising from a moral judgment, something usually only viewed within the narrow confines of ordinary life. It does, however, have a different dimension, too. Everything we do, even a single action, has significance within the whole course of humanity's evolution. But in our ordinary consciousness, we have as little grasp of the worth of every action for evolution as our head grasps how destiny works and acts. In this case, however, the evaluation of an action does not pass through our being as though through a sieve, but as a beam or ray. It radiates outward through the lotus flowers. Subconsciously, we continually evaluate every single one of our actions. Even if you were an angelic type of person and did good to all others, in your subconscious you would evaluate how you behave and act and its value for the whole of humanity's evolution. You do this very objectively, and the outcome may sometimes be very different from what your surface awareness might think. Even if you are a thief, you will judge your own actions even as you perform them, doing so quite objectively, according to their effect on the overall process of human evolution. This inevitably radiates out through the lotus flowers. Just as our judgments about destiny pass through our head as though through a sieve, to be held up and retained by our arms and hands, so, with the aid of our astral lotus flower organism, we conduct the judgments we make about our own actions, also about our thoughts as actions. Through our lotus flower organism, these are radiated outward like light and emerge from us. this shining emanation, goes a long, long way. It passes over into the realm of time rather than remaining in the spatial dimension. This is why it is so difficult to picture the lotus flowers. They are in continual movement and continually cross over into time. Here, space really does become time. We all cast a light before us, one which passes into time, becoming a continual beam that endures way beyond death. Someone is judging within us, in our subconscious, throughout our life. Just as someone thinks our destiny in us, so someone judges our every action, and this judgment we shine out as a beam from ourselves. Naturally, this is put metaphorically, but nevertheless it corresponds to a reality. Life is like a beam cast far ahead by a floodlight. You must picture this happening in time, though, rather than space. For instance, assuming you are 40 at present, let us say that you do something or other, and then your life continues. You grow to be 50, 60. Then you die and continue to exist in the life after death. As you pass through this further existence, you gradually live your way into what you shone out into this existence from your lotus flowers while alive on earth. You meet again everything that you shone forward into the future. To put it metaphorically, again, this is like pointing a floodlight forward so that its beam shines far into the distance, and then moving along it. You meet again everything that you shone forward into the future. And what you meet here in the life between death and rebirth are the judgments you made about your actions. In this regard, the human being is not a sieve. Or actually, you could say that he is, for he allows through everything that he himself subconsciously engenders. Thus, there is something in us that acts as a continual critic, not using this word in a pedantic sense, of our own actions, and shines these judgments forward into our own future. Here again, one can, if one so wishes, see the scientific aspect of this. The fact that we have an upright stance and posture, so that our tool of consciousness rests upon us as upon our own earth, means that at the place where the lotus flowers are situated, we retain or hold back what proceeds from our sojourn on the earth, our travels across it in the broadest sense. It is retained there, turned at right angles, and sent forward into life. In a complex but certainly comprehensible way, as we see, what is usually encompassed in the generalized term the unconscious enters and works upon our life. Our subconscious connects with our whole destiny by virtue of the fact that our diaphragm closes us off in a downward direction. There is no such emanation through the lotus flowers in the animal. Why? This is again connected with the animal's universal orientation. We have a vertical spine at right angles to that of the animal. Because of this, we can develop something impossible for the animal because its spine lies horizontally rather than vertically. The animal cannot, therefore, have a, in quotes, critic beside it, nor send judgments about its animal life ahead of it into the future. Science will become much more productive when it succeeds in going beyond its trivial comparisons between the structure and form of animal limbs and those of the human being, or between the animal head and the human head. While the human being has a more perfect brain, the human head is really not so very different from the animal head. And for this reason, materialist theories have easily assigned human beings their place in the animal world. What really distinguishes the human being from animals, however, is his spatial orientation. A thorough study of this would produce quite different scientific insights. Here, spiritual science will show the way, as it does in other areas, by pointing to specific life processes that only then can be properly understood. In the human being, therefore, we can find aspects that, on the one hand, appear cleverer than he is, sometimes more subtle and astute even, in relation to the way destiny is judged, and on the other hand, aspects that reveal a more objective critic of his actions that he himself is consciously. I think that's supposed to read, then he himself is consciously. And the reader's aside. In a complex sense, therefore, we can say that there is another human being within us, and this comes to expression in life. Usually, people do not observe their actions. The inner critic remains in the subconscious and only becomes conscious between death and rebirth. As we gradually advance along the beam we ourselves have emanated, as I described. However, a judicious, detailed observation of life can show us how this critic behaves differently inside different individuals. Let us compare two different types of people commonly encountered in life. One is often described as a busybody. You can find them everywhere. They never have any spare time, are always on the move, and like to have a finger in every pie, and their nose often in other people's business. Such behavior is held to be a habit formed during life, based on subconscious motivations and so forth. What people do not realize is that the inner critic in such a busybody, in this particular incarnation, has assumed a particular stance. Such a critic also has its distinctive individuality, which people discover after death. It is good to speak of such things with a certain humor. A sense of humor in spiritual science overcomes a mood that is otherwise really very counterproductive. The inner critic in a busybody like this is a kind of actor or performer who wishes to be seen by all and sundry, not just by other people as he may imagine, but by all kinds of spiritual beings. He takes pleasure in the fact that all the beings thronging in the world of spirit can always see him as he rushes about. This type, the busybody, is, in the world of spirit, someone who keeps rushing about and wishes to be seen. And it is this motivation, translated into an unconscious prompting, that gives the person the character of a busybody. What about the opposite type? This is the kind of person who conscientiously does what life requires and demands of him, the duties it imposes. He is not always very visible, but often acts behind the scenes, doing whatever is needed. Here, too, the critic assumes a distinctive stance. Spiritual science can shed light on these things. Here, the critic adopts such a position due to an unconscious belief that everything we do, even if not seen, as the busybody wishes, by the teeming spirits, is not in vain, and that no power in the world is in vain, but has its own significance. It is a lovely thought. Everything you do has significance, some meaning in the overall scheme of things, even if this only emerges in millennia to come. This awareness is rooted in the opposite type from the busybody, a certain trustful resting in the world, a certainty originating in the faith or belief I have described. Life is illumined by perspectives above and beyond outward circumstances in the sense-perceptible world, when we see that there are relationships between our life and the world of spirit. My comments today seek primarily to highlight two elements in human nature. One is connected with our physical organism between birth and death, where our physical organization points to a subconscious realm. Here it becomes apparent that our arms and hands are organs of thinking, albeit in the remarkable sense of giving special ground or soil to what passes through the head as through a sieve. In this respect, we are a special kind of vessel. Our head is a sieve for destiny. But thoughts that destiny creates coagulate as the arms and hands stop and retain them. The second element is what radiates from the lotus flowers, and enters our life between death and a new birth. The relationship between these two streams or currents in us is of great significance. You see, if you consider the whole human being in terms of the diaphragm level, there too you find a dual nature. Something enters us, comes into stasis or stalls due to the power of arms and hands, but nevertheless passes down to the diaphragm level. It stalls, comes into stasis, because we are vertical beings rather than horizontal ones like the animals. This sounds very strange, but the world is full of riddles and mysteries. The animals' legs relate to the latter differently from the way our arms relate to us, and this has something to do with the earth. One sees the rays or beams coming through the earth and entering us, but then guided or directed by the lotus flowers, shining out into the future. The two streams show us to be a dual being. In ordinary life, they are entirely separate from each other, and life depends on this. If they were to join together, life would be different from how it is. In a confluence of the two, humankind could not develop I consciousness, which depends on these two streams being kept distinct and separate. And yet they are only partially sundered, and in a particular different sense they do merge. What radiates from us to shine forward into the life between death and rebirth can, if we succeed in doing this, unite and combine with that other influx of forces usually stopped and held by the arms before these pass through the sieve of the head. The streams can unite with each other outside of us. The two streams, which normally pass through our body but do not join and merge, can unite if we stop them. This in turn makes it possible for us to encounter those who have passed through the gateway of death. This picture of the two streams will serve as an introduction to explorations in the next lecture of the connections with the dead we can develop here on earth, which we will then illumine from a different point of view. The end of Lecture 5.